From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now, or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. You are you, and that makes this stuff they don't want you to know. Everybody listening, please wave a silent hello to our super producer, Paul Deccant, on the ones and twos.
I'm doing it right now.
And you guys are great at this, by the way. You guys should see Matt and Noel at this. I was thinking we could open this up with an out-of-context quote that will later turn out to be really important.
Okay.
All right. You ready?
Are we going to say who it's from or just doing it?
Totally out of context.
Okay.
Totally,
all right.
No attribution whatso, if then ever.
Okay.
Perfect. All right. Agreements are the forces we use to locate ourselves in time and space. Everything that we do is from some agreement that we have set up. Everything that we have in this physical universe is something we have laid out and agreed to. Most people never set time limits to their agreements, so they are forces that continue with no end.
Okay.
All right. Well, out of context, we're just setting up. This is ridiculous foreshadowing, but we do promise it comes into play later. What are we talking about? Something hit the airwaves just recently as we record this, and we kind of knew it was coming, but not so soon.
Yeah, I had no idea. A figure that has been in my life for ever since I was born, as a kind of a specter?
Sort of an American boogeyman.
Yeah.
Mm, that's a great phrase. Yes, we are talking today, for anyone who didn't read the title, we're talking today about the death of Charles Manson. Charles Manson is dead. Charles Mills Manson died on November 19th, 2017 in the Kent County Hospital of Bakersfield, California.
Yeah, and ever since I've been born, he's been in jail. He was incarcerated in 1971, and he was serving time in a California state prison outside of Bakersfield, and he was 83 years old when he died.
And after his death, Manson's grandson revealed that this former cult leader, you know, American boogeyman, like you said, had been in treatment for cancer. So as large as Charlie Manson loomed over the culture of this country, pop culture, all kinds of things, he's been just this specter, like you said. He was human, and he had been being treated for cancer for the past year, and it had been kept a secret and kept inside the family.
And Manson died as he lived, a disturbing figure. And again, not to harp on it too much, but I love that phrase you came up with, American boogeyman, a disturbing figure in, that was caught somewhere between a protagonist for some members of society and ubiquitously regarded as a symbol for the dark, fascinating fall of the so-called hippie era.
I think that's why the boogeyman thing rings true for me, because that was such a time of unhinged, you know, opportunity, prosperity, potentially just like, you know, letting – it was like our country like spreading our wings and flying into our new destiny, and there was this dark byproduct.
The summer of free love. Yeah. Turned out there was quite a price to pay. It was an unhinged cult leader who, despite decades of incarceration, still managed to garner a following amid the loners, the outcasts, and the mentally vulnerable the world over.
And to a lot of the people who were alive at the time when all of the press was coming out, when these crimes were committed by Charles Manson, people who saw the trial and then the sentencing, Charlie Manson should have died a long time ago had California not suspended the death penalty on April 24th, 1971. If they wouldn't have done that, he would have been long gone by this year.
It's crazy, Ben, because it's like to his supporters, it's almost as though he kind of won, right?
Right, because he died in a hospital rather than a prison. The single most significant aspect of Manson's turn as a cult leader and his criminal career is his masterminding of the infamous Tate LaBianca murders. And it leads us to a series of questions that you have probably heard examined at length before in documentaries, in adaptations, in other podcasts, and in numerous printed works. The questions all run around the same sort of orbit, which would be, what possessed these people? What compelled otherwise normal people to join the Manson family and follow this fellow?
How is Charles Manson capable of such cunning manipulation?
And are any of the conspiracy theories that surround Charles Manson and the entire Manson family, are they true?
Here are the facts. We must start at this point. So we're journeying back to November 12th, 1934 to answer these questions in sort of a circuitous, perhaps, but accurate way, mm-hmm. the most accurate we can find. Charles Manson was born Charles Mills Maddox in Cincinnati, Ohio, there in November 12th, 1934. His mother's name was Kathleen Maddox. She was 16 at the time, and according to Manson, she originally named him No Name Maddox, N-O space N-A-M-E Maddox. His father is currently unknown, or at least publicly unidentified. Eventually, Charles Maddox took his stepfather's surname, which made him officially Charles Manson, and his earlier years were, in a single word, horrific.
Yeah, and what we've done is gone through some of the fact and fiction, some of the mythology here, trying to figure out what's what, and here are some of the proven examples of terrible things that happened to the young Charles Manson.
Yeah, this stuff is pretty bleak. Manson's mother sold him for a pitcher of beer to a woman who wanted to have children, and his uncle had to seek out this woman and get young Charles back.
Yeah.
Apparently the story went that Charles's mother said, I heard the server, she was talking to the server at this bar and said, you know, I heard you want kids, you can have mine for a pitcher of beer. They were joking. The server thought mm-hmm. they were joking. She brought the beer and Manson's mom downed the pitcher, did a dine and what is it?
Dine and dash.
Dine and dash. That's the word. That's the phrase. She did a dine and dash and left the baby there.
Jeez.
I mean, she was clearly mentally ill.
In 1947, he's caught stealing and he's sent to a school for boys in Indiana. And there, from that point, he spends the next two decades in and out of reform schools, juvenile detention, and eventually prison.
Yeah. And then Manson himself alleged staunchly for his entire life that he was sexually assaulted numerous times by multiple assailants while at this and other institutions. So saying that, you know, not only was his childhood terrible with all these things happen, mm-hmm. a mother who wouldn't even give him a name, then he moved on to living in these institutions where he was just abused, at mm-hmm. least according to Charles Manson.
And as he continued committing crimes, being imprisoned and released, then imprisoned again, he became a career offender, more comfortable, arguably, outside of the bounds of the law than within them.
And then in 1967, when he was set to be released from prison, he actually begged to stay inside the jail. He said he was incapable of living outside the walls of the prison, as though I can function inside here, but not out there anymore, because this is my new home. And that's sad,
mm-hmm.
but it's also something we've kind of heard before, where once you get used to that, the structure of a prison life, it's very difficult to function outside.
Yeah, was it like in the Shawshank Redemption where when Morgan Freeman's character finally gets released at the end and he just doesn't know how to go about day-to-day life because he's been in for so long?
It's a real thing that real people experience all the time.
It makes sense, but it is mm-hmm. absolutely, as you say, quite sad.
And what a world Charles Manson found when he was released in 1967. This is, as we said, the height of the free love movement. Haight-Ashbury becoming a mecca of sorts, a holy site for this ideology, which is sweeping the nation, running counter to U.S. foreign policy in Vietnam and abroad. Manson is by now a hardened criminal, and he's released from a place called McNeil Island Prison in Washington State. He had at this point been serving 7 years for transporting women across state lines for the purpose of prostitution and also for forging checks. Yeah, he traveled to San Francisco, and he attracted a following among many rebellious young people with troubled emotional lives, sort of adrift in the world. He was a little older than most of his followers. He was 32 years old, and there was this amazing, people described it as almost palpable feeling in the air that the world could be changed in a positive way, that with enough positive thought, we might be able to set things right. And he embraced this mysticism wholeheartedly.
Yeah, I mean, think about his life up until this point. This is why it's so important. Let's just say for argument here, Manson probably hasn't experienced a whole lot of physical love the way a child would throughout their life, and then growing up maybe a teenager and then maybe a 20-something. There is free love, free food, lots of hugging. There's marijuana. There's acid. There are girls. So many girls.
Did you just say lots of hugging?
Lots of hugging. Oh, there is hugging.
Was
hugging,
that a hallmark?
I mean, 60s? Yeah. Hugging and just touching like, affectionately without strings attached, that kind of thing. I mean, anyway.
Can't walk down the street without some jabroni trying to put their arms around you.
Yeah. And just be like, you know what? Everything's good, man.
It was a real hug fest.
So, but specifically and not jokingly, we're talking about these women, these young women that he ended up being around. Most of them lost girls or lost girls, looking for someone to tell them that they'd been found in some way, in a place that would accept them.
Remember that book, Go Ask Alice? Did you ever have to read that in high school?
Mm-hmm.
It's like about the girl who leaves home and becomes like, well, she's on LSD and ends up like in horrible situations, but it's that total lost girl kind of scenario. And I believe it turned out that book was kind of just like almost borderline propaganda, but it was so effective because it was a real story, you know, in terms of like that type of thing happened quite often. And a guy like Manson would be the perfect, I don't know. They would be the perfect mark for a guy like Manson, who kind of had his wiles and, you know, was a musician and kind of seen as this like edgy kind of figure, you know?
Well, yeah, he had a certain set of skills.
Right. Yes. He thrived. This, guru slash fill-in father figure, played the guitar. He had that dangerous mystique of an ex-con. And one thing that's interesting is he studied a lot of stuff extensively in prison, and we'll get to some of that. And when he landed in Haight-Ashbury, he walked around and listened to the various street preachers, the various poets and prophets, and picked the pieces of their what they called raps at that time. Doesn't resemble the kind of rap that we listen to today. More like a almost free flowing, occasionally rhyming, declarative mode of speech.
It was almost just that like that cadence of like a revival preacher, a big tent revival preacher, or something like that. In a way,
yeah, stuff you could dig, right? And so he agglomerated this and created his own sort of mixtape of that You Can Be Free metaphysical rap, and people loved it. He started garnering followers like Mary Brunner, Lynette Fromm, later known as Squeaky, Susan Atkins, Sandra Good, and this was the beginning of what prosecutors would later call The Family, with a capital F.
Yeah, and The Family eventually moved to Los Angeles because Manson wanted to be a rock star, and he actually was successful at least in making some good contacts. Mm-hmm. He was friends with Dennis Wilson from the Beach Boys. I believe there's even an incident where they cut him or they cut his ear off or something like that? What was that about?
They got, it did turn ugly.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. But he was also friends with a very well-known record producer by the name of Terry Melcher. And just to give you a little taste, you guys might have heard this, but, Manson wasn't a very good musician. And here's an example.
Oh, garbage dump. Oh, garbage dump. Why are you called a garbage dump? Oh, garbage dump, oh, garbage dump. Why are you called a garbage dump?
That was a snippet of Garbage Dump by Charles Manson.
Why do they call it a garbage dump?
That's the you know, that's the question.
That's a great question.
I think that's interesting. It's great to put that in context because he learned slide guitar originally while he was incarcerated, and so much of an individual's success in the music industry then as today hinges upon one's charisma.
Right. Yeah.
And there are critics aplenty who will tell you that such and such and so are skating by on charisma rather than musical merit. However, after Manson was making these connections, along with his family as an entourage, by the way, he racked up, Dennis Wilson claims that the family racked up $100,000 plus in expenses for food, for drugs, for socially transmitted disease treatment. Mm. And this darker turn occurs in 1969. Manson had always been physically and emotionally abusive to the women under his sway, but with the release of the Beatles' White Album, he took a sharp turn into apocalyptic beliefs, signified perhaps most apparently by his complex interpretation of the song Helter Skelter.
By the Beatles.
Yeah, that's not a bad one, man. I'm glad that you put some levity in here because we're going to need it in a little bit.
Yeah. We can't play a clip from that song because it's the Beatles.
Right. We can't legally play one for you, but we can invite you to check out the song if you haven't heard it before.
Well, should we just do a little lyric snippet perhaps?
Oh, all right.
Yeah, maybe a reading.
Do a little reading. So here's a snippet from the lyrics, Helter Skelter. It's actually pretty simple lyrics, but Manson really took a lot out of it. It goes like this. When I get to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide, where I stop and I turn and I go for a ride, till I get to the bottom and I see you again. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hey, do you, don't you, want me to love you? I'm coming down fast, but I'm miles above you. Tell me, tell me, tell me. Come on, tell me the answer. Well, you may be a lover, but you ain't no dancer. Helter Skelter, Helter Skelter, Helter Skelter, yeah, ooh.
And man, what Charles Manson heard when he listened to those lyrics and the music combined was something beyond what I interpret when I listen to the song. And let's get exactly into what he thought it meant after a quick word from our sponsor.
So Manson, from these lyrics, or using these lyrics as a basis or a foundation, told his followers, as he was building them into a cult, that he had an epiphany of sorts, mm-hmm. a revelation from the lyrics of Helter Skelter. He did not see it as his interpretation. He saw it as a divine message to himself. He also believed that all people were God. He saw it as a divine message that a race war was imminent, specifically between the white population of the United States and the black population, that the black population would win but be, according to his beliefs, inherently unable to self-govern, and that during the race war, the family, the Manson family, would hide out in an underground cave, a cavern system that he called the bottomless pit, a land of milk and honey. And after the race war, when all the quote unquote pigs and the squares mm-hmm. and the other white people were dead, from America, there would emerge five ruling angels. Manson, who would play the role of a new Jesus Christ, accompanied by his disciples, and the four members of the musical group, the Beatles.
Wow. Sounds pretty compelling. Yeah.
It sounds like, you know, it's weird because it sounds like a lot to take in. It sounds like a tall milkshake when you're just hearing it laid out as an elevator pitch.
Sounds like OT level 3.
right. Oof, we have to be careful.
Oh, I mean, yeah. Okay.
And that's right, Matt, not for nothing, but we are definitely going to have to mention our good buddies, the Church of Scientology, at some point later, either in this episode or in part two, if we get to a part two. The thing is, with these sorts of beliefs, with any belief that seems unreasonable, we have to realize the context in which it occurs. It's like the salesperson foot in the door technique. Mm-hmm. You don't get all of this at once.
No.
You get it after your time, your money, your mental energy have become sunk cost. Which we're borrowing a phrase from economics. And the point is that you feel like every time you've been like, well, I've already put this much time in.
I just have to keep going.
Right. Like if you're watching a movie that's 4 hours long and you're 3 hours and 40 minutes into it.
Can't just stop.
And you're like, oh, God, man, yeah, what am I going to do? I got to see it to the end. Manson's descent into madness began at a place called, or really kicked into gear, we should say, a place called Span Ranch.
I just want to know, like, how he took so much meaning from those simple Beatles lyrics. Like, what if he had just seen a kid playing on a slide? Do you think he would have had the same revelation?
Interesting. I think maybe when you combine the musical portion of that song with perhaps the right cocktail of drugs or, you know, whatever you're going through, and some of the other ideas that were already kind of seeping into him.
It was like triggering.
Yeah.
Or the right confidence and the right relentless megalomania. That's a perfect word, Matt. After the falling out with Dennis Wilson, the family relocated to this ranch, which was about 20 miles away from Los Angeles, but a very different environment. And we can give you a little bit of background because the ranch is an interesting place.
Yes, Span Ranch was founded in 1885, and after changing hands a number of times, it became the property of George Span in 1953.
Is this you doing like the resort-style commercial for Span Ranch?
That's exactly what's happening.
Nice.
Oh, I was hoping for a Robin Leach, but this is great too.
In 1968, when the family came to the ranch, Span was in his late 70s, terribly lonely and mostly blind. His wife managed the property, but the two didn't seem to have a close relationship, and Span let out-of-work ranch hands live on the property in exchange for labor. At the time, the ranch was occasionally used as a backdrop in TV shows, and it also made money renting horses to tourists.
Interesting side note, this area had hosted cults before. In the 1940s and 50s, there was another cult called the Fountain of the World in nearby Box Canyon. They were led by a charismatic figure who called himself Krishna Venta. Although, of course, that was not his birth name. They built a monastery on the property. Charles Manson himself allegedly had been at the monastery sometime before or after disgruntled ex-members blew up the building in 1958, killing Venta and seven others. Those two ex-members who blew it up, by the way, did so because, as is so common in many cults of personality, the leader had a revelation that he should be sleeping with everybody's wife.
Yep.
And actually, there was a pretty interesting account of Manson at Span Ranch that came out not long after he passed away. Bryan Cranston from Breaking Bad and Malcolm in the Middle, fantastic actor who was 61, wrote on social media, quote, "Hearing Charles Manson is dead, I shuddered. I was within his grasp just 1 year before he committed brutal murder in 1969. Luck was with me when a cousin and I went horseback riding at the Span Ranch and saw the little man with crazy eyes whom the other hippies called Charlie."
Ooh.
Interesting. Oh, what a web we see weaving here. And, you know, regardless of the previous cult's activities in the 40s and 50s, Charles Manson and George Span came to an understanding. The family, they decided, would live on the property, help out around the ranch, and in exchange, the female members of the family would attend to George Span's daily needs, including everything from cooking and cleaning to laundry and sexual satiation. For Manson, however, there was a much more important and perhaps subtler advantage. He would finally have the followers of the Manson family isolated from the world and completely subsumed into his influence.
Yeah, it was during this time at the Spahn Ranch that he began really working on these techniques that are common to cult leaders. He was a big fan of forcing dissociative states on his followers through drug use, largely, and also the kind of emotional and physical abuse you could probably imagine as well. This allowed him to remove a sense of self, ego, and esteem from his followers. And some of these techniques included things like mandatory orgies. He also compelled his followers to listen to long, repetitive lectures on the coming race war. And as the cult began to take this darker, more sinister and violent turn during this these times of isolation, the ranch hands at the ranch, and as well as Spahn's estranged wife, warned him to take it easy. Take it easy, George. You really need to distance yourself from this guy. He's kind of freaking us out.
Yeah, he's kind of freaking us out. Even Bryan Cranston doesn't like him. And everybody loves Bryan. This shows us a very disturbing pattern that's common in a lot of cults. In the past, we have asked ourselves, you know, what is the difference between a religious movement and what's the difference between a cult? Because one person's true religion is another person's cult, and is the term cult just always a pejorative? We did a YouTube episode, right? It was just we did one episode on the common practices of cults, and we highly recommend it because the steps are almost distressingly and eerily similar from one cult to the next. You can also see some neat vignettes, cameos featuring Charles Bryant from Stuff You Should Know and Jonathan Strickland from Tech Stuff fame.
Yeah, and you can also see how some of these same techniques you would use to garner a following in that way are used outside of cult activities as psychological almost weapons to get people to do certain things. When you look at, I don't want to get too dark, but you look at marketing and PR sometimes and you see some of these same things occurring.
Oh, absolutely. And just to plant the seed for later discussions about magic and the occult, I'm always drawn back to one of my favorite quotes from our friend Damian Patrick Williams, who said, if you have problems believing in magic as a concept, just think of it as weaponized psychology.
Yeah.
And when you think about that, it makes it much more real. So as Noel said, things are getting dire, right? Mm-hmm. Manson is lying to his followers and probably to himself, you know?
Yeah.
There's a certain necessity in believing one's own rap, as they would call it. And he told them, you know, they were hunting for this enormous cavern. Helter Skelter was on the way, and they, the chosen few, that's another thing very common with cults, would safely wait out the coming Armageddon. Eventually, you see, what happened is that Manson grew tired of waiting for the world to end, and he told his followers to prime the pump.
And what happens next will live in infamy forever, I would say. It's one of the most horrific cult-based murders of all time. And we're going to talk very specifically about that right after one more quick sponsor break.
Helter Skelter. The apocalyptic prophecy of Manson, as told to his followers, was seen as inevitable, but on a flexible timeline, meaning that in their internal logic, it was possible to nudge this into occurring a little bit earlier than they would otherwise expect. They began committing murders. You'll hear a lot about Tate LaBianca, but on July 27th, 1969, some of his followers killed a man named Gary Hinman, allegedly because he would not join Manson's rock band. In August 8th, 1969, four of Manson's followers drove to a place called CeeLo Drive, breaking into the home of the then not yet exposed and disgraced director and pedophile Roman Polanski, as his pregnant wife, actress Sharon Tate, entertained friends at the residence. Manson was not there.
No.
Not that night, but he sent four of his followers.
Yeah, he sent the, we're going to call them cult members, Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, Linda Kasabian, and Patricia Krenwinkel. They were all acting under orders from Manson to destroy, this is important here, destroy everyone in the house in as gruesome a manner as possible. The victims were, as noted, the 8.5 months pregnant Sharon Tate, which is just awful. Her former lover, Jay Sebring, the screenwriter, Wojtek Frykowski, his lover, Abigail Folger, who was the heiress to the Folger Coffee Company, and one other person, a student named Stephen Parent, who was literally just there to visit the caretaker.
And the caretaker lived on site. Mm-hmm. After brutally choking, stabbing, and executing their victims, these cult members followed Manson's orders to leave a sign, quote, something witchy. Atkins wrote pig on the front door of the house in Tate's blood. They ditched their clothes and weapons in the hills on their escape from the scene. In the logic of the family, this murder was a false flag of sorts. Manson was perturbed that his predicted race war had yet to begin, and he believed that the murders would nudge these racial tensions in the U.S., that white observers would believe this is the work of militant black supremacist groups, and that naturally, in his, as you can see, his clearly racist mindset, naturally things would progress. But he was displeased by what he saw as a sloppy performance on the part of his cult members. That's another thing you do when you're a cult leader. You constantly degrade, mm-hmm. undermine, what's the word pickup artists use? Neg? You constantly neg your followers. So no matter what they do, it's never good enough. And he accompanied them along with two other followers, Leslie Van Houten and Steve Clem Grogan, to, quote, show them how to do it. They went to a different house.
So they arrived at the home of a Supermart executive by the name of Leno LaBianca and his wife, Rosemary, which was just next door to a house where Manson and his crew had been to a party before. So after killing LaBianca and his wife, the crew left the word war carved into the wife's abdomen, along with rise, death to the pigs, and helter skelter. But they actually misspelled it. It was added an A to make it helter skelter. And they wrote that on the fridge door, also in the victim's blood.
And for a time, it seemed as though the family would get away with this, mm-hmm. right? The same forensic techniques that law enforcement possesses today were not in play in the late 1960s. Within days after the murders, two Manson family members are actually arrested for car theft.
Yeah. And then everybody else, the Manson family, including the man himself, they fled to hideouts in Death Valley because they were fearing, I'm sure, that, hey, two of our people got picked up. Something's going down where we might get caught.
Mm-hmm. And then on October 12th, Manson himself was found hiding in a cupboard in Barker Ranch. All in all, 27 people were arrested
for car theft. Yep.
So there's no connection at this point still between these murders, these horrific murders, and this thing that appears for all intents and purposes to be a cult-themed Grand Theft Auto ring. Susan Atkins, however, rolls in prison. She's boasting of murders that they've committed. And then later she ends up cutting a deal with prosecution. December 19th of the same year, this hits the mainstream. In Life magazine, there's a feature that's run. Manson gains global notoriety as the Western world learns of Helter Skelter. There's a 7-month trial, a 7-month trial that arguably today would maybe be a mistrial because the president at the time, Richard Nixon, President Nixon is going, this guy's guilty.
Yeah.
Put him under the jail, kill him, you know. And we were talking before off air, and you have to wonder nowadays, the three of us are always wondering what an historical event would be like if it occurred in the age of Twitter, right?
Yeah.
Well, what Nixon strikes me as a Twitter-friendly president.
I can imagine Nixon's Twitter account.
Mm-hmm. And I can imagine, you know, people were chiming in with these various opinions, but for an elected official to say someone's guilty before a trial comes out, for the highest elected official in the land to say this could very well have injured the proceedings.
That's not good for law.
Right. Nonetheless, the jury finds all the defendants guilty on January 25th, 1971, and in March of 1971, March the 29th, Manson, Krenwinkel, Atkins, and Van Houten are sentenced with the death penalty. Watson is also sentenced, but at a later date receives the death penalty. But then, as we said in the beginning, California suspends the death penalty shortly thereafter, and the family's sentences are commuted to life in prison.
Yeah, only two family members have been, as of 2017, paroled. Steve Goggin, who was 17 at the time, and he was the guy who served as the lookout, and also Lynette Squeaky Fromm, who attempted to assassinate President Gerald Ford.
Right. That is, you know, that's after Watergate occurs here. Mm-hmm. So what we're also seeing is a tremendous amount of strange and tragic events, right? Disastrous events in a very short frame of time, span of time. Oh, an important note, as we're recording this today, it is quite possible that a third family member may see freedom. Leslie Van Houten was recently granted parole, however, is not out of the gate, or should I say out of the bars yet, because this situation has come up before, and the governor of California, the state in which Van Houten is currently incarcerated, has 120 days from the parole ruling to either reverse the ruling, modify it, grant it, or make no comment. And in other cases, the governor has consistently denied parole. So it is quite possible that by the time this podcast publishes, there may be a third member out in the free world. Mm. But currently, that's not the case, and the indications are not really in the favor of parole, if past behavior is a precedent.
Charles Manson, however, the person that masterminded, at least according to the law and according to witnesses, masterminded all of these murders and other nefarious deeds that the family did, he spent the rest of his life, from this point forward, in prison.
Where he lived as a celebrity. As Knowles said, an American boogeyman. I promise I'm not going to overuse that, but I think it's really good.
Well, thanks, man.
Manson received more mail than any inmate in U.S. history, and he formed intense bonds with admirers. He readily agreed to interviews, clips of which you can see on YouTube today. He had various marriage proposals, mm-hmm. got some marriage licenses.
He rolls the nickels.
Yeah.
My favorite Manson interview segment.
How did you find that one?
It was you, actually.
Was it?
Should we play a little bit of it? That's a good one.
I don't want to take my time going to work. I got a motorcycle and a sleeping bag and 10 or 15 girls. What the hell I want to go off and go to work for? Work for what? Money? I got all the money in the world. I'm the king, man. I run the underworld, guy. I decide who does what and where they do it at. What am I going to run around and act like I'm some teeny bopper somewhere for somebody else's money? I make the money, man. I roll the nickels. The game is mine. I deal the cards.
And yeah, in that you can hear, even later in his life, he's older at this point. He's got that manic kind of cadence of the street preacher going for him, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I don't want to take my time going to work. Yeah. And there's a bit of cadence, a poetry, of course, to it, at least in terms of the language. And now, despite all the claims of godhood and divine nature, Charles Manson is dead. It's strange that the three of us have not explored this topic before. Earlier, we noted that our mission for this series was going to be to determine what, if any, conspiracy theories surrounding the Manson family, Manson's background, the murders, and his later time in prison were true. And as we've realized, diving into this extremely disturbing rabbit hole, this is more than one episode. In fact, we have to dedicate an entire episode, a part two, solely to the conspiracy theories surrounding the life of Charles Manson. So it is here that we must pause for a moment. But although we are, you know, and we know that it can feel kind of strange for us to say, here is the background, here is part one of an episode, but we will return with part two of the episode. And in the meantime, we don't want to leave you in the dark. We'd like to invite you to check out some further reading.
Yes. One thing we urge you to check out until we meet again is a book called Member of the Family, written by Diane Lake and Deborah Herman. It is the story of Charles Manson, the life inside his cult and the darkness that ended the 60s. And it's written by a person, Diane Lake, who was a part of the family, someone who had inside experience of what it was like to be manipulated by Charles Manson and how the techniques that we've been discussing that he was using, what it felt like to be under the spell of some of that stuff. And, it gets a lot into the lost girl mentality that we were speaking about, Noel. A lot of that feeling of not having a family, but then being accepted into this group, and the techniques of the girls, the family itself that were surrounding Charles Manson, how they would bring in, almost as an amoeba, bring in other girls into the fold. It's fascinating and pretty dark stuff, but it's worth reading.
You can also check out one of the most well-known and comprehensive books written about the trial and Manson's background, which is Helter Skelter, published in 1974 by Vincent Bugliosi and Kurt Gentry, Vincent being the primary prosecutor for the Manson trial. And in there, you will find quite a few things that don't make it into many examinations of this strange, tragic, dare I say disastrous, tale in American history. We'd like to know what you think. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook,
where we are Conspiracy Stuff on most of those. On Instagram, we are Conspiracy Stuff Show. But if you don't want to do any of that stuff, if you have any tales that you wish to tell us, any ideas, write to us. We are
Conspiracy at HowStuffWorks.com.